Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania state prison population declined by more than 1,000 last year. The number of people incarcerated has dropped in 6 out of the last 7 years. There are more than 47,000 people behind bars. So what's behind the decline? Also, Pennsylvania has become the first state in the country with a clean slate law to help ex-offenders wipe the records clean. These are among the topics we'll discuss today with Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel. Secretary Wetzel, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So certainly good news, but why the decline in the prison population?
Well, we've really been working on this for, 8 years, literally. It started under Governor Corbett, and in 2012, we passed the first Justice Reinvestment Initiative. If you look over that time frame, since that time frame, our population is down over 4,000, which is very significant. I mean, we've closed prisons. We've flattened out the expenditures and really focused on a couple areas. Parole violators, doing a better job keeping people out. And when we bring people back, abbreviating the time, which is supported by research. Focus on who's coming in. So we have less new commits. And recidivism is down. So we're really, I think, taking a holistic approach to attack it, to set people coming out of prison up to be successful so they're less likely to come back.
But, okay, now, the two areas that kind of answer why the decline has occurred, court commitments and parole violations. I want to talk about each one. First of all, what is a court commitment?
That's people sentenced to state prison from a county.
Okay.
So I think one of the big things over the, and I think last time I was on or two times ago, we talked about mandatory minimums
right. Getting
thrown out. So that's one of the contributors this year, with those drug mandatories being thrown out. They're no longer, that's lessened the amount of people coming in. And I think in a good way. I think one of the things we're seeing in the criminal justice system in this opioid era is we're seeing a bunch of people coming into the criminal justice system who don't have a long criminal history, but get a bunch of arrests because they became addicted. That group of individuals really benefits from being diverted, treated for their drug addiction, and they're unlikely to commit a crime when you do that. When drug mandatories are in place, that profile of person comes to state prison, and then when they leave state prison, they're more likely to commit another crime. So I think when you talk about court commits, one of the drivers is mandatory minimums. We also have D.A. Krasner in Philadelphia, who's come in as a big reformer. I think last year was his first year, probably some of that impact, and I can't tell you exactly how much we're looking at that now, would be from a kind of reform-oriented prosecutor in Philadelphia where 27% of our commitments come from.
And that last part is one of the more important things when you're talking about one district attorney, Larry Krasner, that, think about Philadelphia's population, and that is where the biggest number of offenders come from. But let me just, since you brought that up, there have been criticisms of D.A. Krasner. Some say, he's been lauded for his reform efforts, but there are others say that, and in fact, I think the FOP in Philadelphia said that the D.A. thinks too much about the offenders and not enough about victims.
Yeah, I think that it's a real common narrative to pit victims and offenders and those kinds of things. And I think when someone comes in with a reform agenda, you're going to get some criticism. I think it really comes down to individual decisions on individual cases. And no matter what your orientation is, either lock them up or keep them all out. We got to focus on putting an individual on a path so they're less likely to commit another crime. And when they're less likely to commit another crime, we're less likely to have victims. There's certainly criticism for everybody on every side in this day and age, but certainly from a numbers standpoint, it's had an impact.
When you say, and we've had this conversation before, but that those that, with the mandatory sentences not being utilized as often, especially for someone who's been arrested multiple times for an opioid-related offense, does that count offenses that may have occurred, like robberies or burglaries, that someone who is breaking the law in another way to feed their habit?
No, not necessarily. It doesn't necessarily count that. I think what primarily you're looking at as it relates to the drug mandatories in particular, or selling like in a school zone or those kinds of things. But I think there's one other piece of data that we need to contextualize this. You know, crime's lower than 8 years ago, right? Also.
Well, everywhere. I mean, for the last 20 years, it's
right,
down.
100%. So, right. So when you look at a significant reduction, I mean, this year over a 2% reduction in state prison population, crime down, no mandatory minimums, that's a pretty good story. Throw in the fact that our recidivism rate, both our 6-month, 1 year, and 3-year recidivism rate is down also. You know, something's working.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talked about the court commitments, but parole violations are down as well. How did that occur?
Well, I think one of the realities of our parole situation currently is that at the end of last year, at the end of 17, the governor, through an executive order, combined parole supervision under Department of Correction. I think we've seen improvements in our approach to supervising inmates or individuals reentrants coming out of prison. I think our numbers aren't solid yet, but it looks like we have an increase in the percentage of people on parole who are employed, or employment rates up. And really, again, not having two separate agencies working with the same people, eliminating some of the bureaucracy, but also eliminating mission divergence, where while both agencies are generally looking at the same thing, there's differences, all under one entity, really, I think, improves outcomes by eliminating some of those communication gaps.
Mm-hmm. We have several phone calls already. Let's take one from Ben in Camp Hill. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Ben Paulding with Colleen Asbury. Just curious to know, as we are freeing up a lot of these individuals due to this clean slate law, what trades should be ready to take these folks and to reintegrate them into the workforce?
Hey, thank you very much.
Any research on that?
All right, thank you very much for your call. Before you answer, now he brought up clean slate, and I was going to get there, but since Ben brought it up, we'll talk about that right off the bat. What is clean slate? It went into effect Christmas Day here in Pennsylvania, first of its kind in the nation. What is it? What's its purpose?
Yeah, basically, what clean slate does is it seals criminal records after 10 years crime free for most misdemeanors, nonviolent misdemeanors. First of its kind in the country, especially the part which hasn't kicked in yet when it's automatic, right? And this was, again, one of those right and left situations. In the House, it was Cheryl DeLosier and Jordan Harris, right?
Republican and Democrat.
And in the Senate, it was Senator Wagner and Tony Williams, right? So you had kind of rural central PA, conservative, Philly, not rural, not conservative, agreeing that folks should get a second chance. It's like creating a path to redemption. The governor certainly championed this, and Pennsylvania is the only state in the country that's done this so far. I think there's a lot of states who are going to follow it. So to the caller's question about employment, you know, one of the things with unemployment as low as it is we have a lot of trades, a lot of folks looking for people coming out of prison to work, more than ever in my career. So it's... having a criminal record, especially a felony, is often makes it difficult to get a job, but we see a lot in manufacturing. We see a lot in the building trades, construction, warehousing, truck driving, diesel mechanics, those kinds of things. So right now, the workforce needs are conducive to people coming out of prison.
There are jobs out there.
Certainly.
I'm sure, though, there are still some employers who stay away from former offenders.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Are there industries where, I mean, are these things, by the way, should ask, you know, you're talking about the industries, do the inmates get any kind of training in those fields when they still are behind bars?
Yeah, absolutely. We have 90 different vocational programs that we offer. Most of them certificate programs provided by our staff. But we've, 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, we got a Department of Ed grant, $1 million Department of Ed grant on workforce development in particular, that has us working with labor and industry and the workforce folks to really identify by area what jobs are needed. And then we're modifying our programming to provide those skills so folks coming out can hit the ground running. We've also, at all our prisons, created transitional housing units. They're literally doing job fairs inside every one of our prisons. So we're really putting a big emphasis and a big focus on trying to develop marketable job skills for individuals coming out of prison and setting them up to be able to get a job when they get out.
You know, this is all positive news. What do you do with lifers, those who have been sentenced to life and no possibility of parole?
Yeah, and just to contextualize that, Pennsylvania's a life means life state. So 5,000 or I guess over 10% of our population now is will be spend the rest of their life in prison. They still work. We actually, some of our longer serving lifers often serve as tutors and mentors. And it's actually a population that coming into this job 8 years ago, I thought was the group you have to worry about. The reality is they're probably some of our best inmates.
Why?
And the best people.
Well, why is that? I mean, I think most people would have the same assumption that you did.
Yeah. I guess my theory is that at some point, when you get older, you know, we're talking people who've served decades, right? And they're not going to get out. So they just trying to make the best of their life. And one of the things I've seen almost across the board for long-term lifers is this, at some point they become altruistic and really want to have a positive impact on their community. And in our case, their community is a prison. But we've also seen places like Great Afford, which is now Phoenix, where lifers are actually working with youth in the community through different groups, really trying to have an impact on the community also. So it's a, you know, there's been a lot of talk at the end of last year about does life without parole make sense in Pennsylvania? I think it's something, you know, we're going to have some conversations about this term. Couple specific groups. We have Vietnam-era veterans, right, who got life. If they were sentenced today, PTSD would be a mitigating factor. We didn't know anything about PTSD back in the 70s. You could say the same for females who were battered, right? Now we know the impact of that. It's a mitigating factor. I think you also, there's another category where we have people who are serving life for second-degree murder where they weren't the trigger person. Felony murder. That's very unique around the country. And those are three, I think, groups that we really should take a look at to see, does life without parole make sense for those groups?
In times that we've talked in the past, I know that you rely heavily on research. Is there research into those things that you just discussed?
As far as, there's research about people aging out of crime. There's research about the amount of previous offenses. In many of these categories, you don't see a long history of previous offenses. You don't see a lot of arrests prior to them committing the crime they did. That would suggest lower risk. And when you're talking about 50, 60, 70-year-old folks who've served that much time, and if they're misconduct-free for decades, I mean, that's a profile that I think from a risk standpoint, probably not a huge concern. I think the other side of that coin, though, is, you know, when a victim sits in court and gets an assurance from the system that they're not going to have to deal with this again, right? That they're not going to have to go back to court or this or that. We made a promise to a victim. So I think that's what we have to wrestle with.
Well, and yeah, and thinking about that other side, society sometimes, whether, you know, the death penalty is a whole other issue. But if someone has committed the ultimate crime, society wants the ultimate punishment.
Yep.
In many cases.
Yep. And I think that's really what policymakers have to, I mean, there's two ends to every coin. And I really think it's important that when we talk about this, we contextualize it in that manner, that we say, look, there's a victim whose voice needs to be heard by the system. The system has to respect and be responsive to the needs of victims because no one signs up to be a victim. Mm-hmm. Right. By the same token, there's other considerations. Part of a correction system should be that public safety. So if someone is zero risk or very little risk to public safety, then at what point is enough, right? I think there's another, I think, dynamic with this, and that's retroactive versus moving forward. I think you could have some really good conversations moving forward at what they should look like. I think you struggle to make something like that retroactive looking back when you have that phenomenon where victims thought that this person was doing life, and now we're talking about the person who did something to their family member, maybe getting a shot that they didn't think they were going to get before. So I think that's really what you're going to see a struggle with over the next couple of years.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel. We're talking about criminal justice reform, prisons. There's a lot of issues we're going to try to get to today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Heather in Lititz. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes,
I have, this is near and dear to my heart. Both of my brothers were locked up in either local, state, or federal prison. The one, and it made it really difficult when they got out, that they come out of prison with a one-way bus ticket in most cases, and no ID, no birth certificate, no social security card. They never turned in their licenses. And I know this for a fact on the other side because I'm an employer who hires previously incarcerated individuals. A lot of the guys that come out, they come out 5-10 years later. One guy was even 30 years later. He never had his license turned in. So he came out and not able to even get a driver's license to work. They come out without a social security card, without a birth certificate, without a photo ID from the state, without a driver's license. And you're only asking for these guys to get locked back up when you send them out into the world like that. I personally spend my own money going and getting these guys those documents, which sometimes take 2 weeks, sometimes take 2 months to get. They get really unhappy when they're trying to get their license, and their license was never formally turned into PennDOT, even though they've been locked up for 5-10 years, and now they can't get a license. Now they got to start that time, and sometimes it's 2-3 years before they can get a license. And that needs to be fixed if you don't want these guys to go back to jail. You can't send them out into the world with $5 and prison uniforms or prison attire and nothing to get them out there working.
Heather, thank you very much for your call. What about that?
Yeah, I actually agree with that 100%, which is why in 2013, I believe, we executed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Transportation to allow us to get individuals coming out of prison their IDs. So if you're coming in and doing longer than 6 months, our rate is about 90% of people getting out with a state ID, and that's, we have a cooperative agreement with the Department of Labor and Industry. So coming out from state prison, if you've served enough of the people who have at least a year to serve, we're about 90% coming out with ID. But the lady is 100% correct. And the reason we did that is because when you break down reentry, look at things that are barriers. ID is a huge barrier. I think one of the other things that happened last year was there was a bill passed that that did something about the automatic license suspensions. I don't remember the details of that bill, but there's some categories who used to get their license suspended that are no longer getting their license suspended. But she's 100% right on with that. But at the state level, we certainly have a solution. Feds do not do that. The feds are in a different ball game in that there's 120-ish federal prisons all over the country. They don't have cooperative agreements with each Department of Transportation, which would be what it would take to get that ID. As far as Social Security card and birth certificate, that's a little more complicated. And we dealt with that several years ago when the juvenile lifers got eligibility for parole.
After the Supreme Court.
Yeah, there was juvenile lifers who had been with us for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And it took Herculean efforts to get Social Security card or birth certificate because it's like a chicken or the egg. You have to have one to get the other. And when you have neither, you're not in a good place.
But the Department of Corrections, that you actually are assisting these former offenders, these ex-offenders, in helping them to get this kind of information.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I think that memorandum of understanding with labor industry has been in place since 2013, I believe. Mm.
Something else, when we're talking about you know, those who are being released, there was a story on NPR this morning, and they focused on California, made it sound like it was a revolutionary program. Former inmates, and maybe it is revolutionary across the country, but former inmates that there was an organization that would pay for their housing, that housing is one of the most difficult things to get besides a job, but housing as well. Pennsylvania has had something in place for some time now.
Right? Yeah, we have a housing assistance program for people coming out of prison, and that started under the Corbett administration, actually, so I believe it was 2014. And what that looks like, what we did is we looked at half the people who were coming out were going through a halfway house. Halfway house at the time cost us about $70 a day. Okay, so people stayed on average 90 days. That was $3,600 that we were spending for a halfway house with no housing permanence. We found that we could put someone in a housing assistance program, walk them through some programming on how to be a responsible renter or house owner, and then get them a 6-month rent for cheaper than that with better outcomes. So we've been doing that since 2014. Now, when you talk about housing, when you talk about individuals who are addicted, when you talk about individuals with mental illness, when you talk about individuals coming out of prison, housing is always the elephant in the room. So we work hand in hand with the Department of Human Services and their housing specialists to really try to focus on that. It also, from a population standpoint, one of the limiting factors of individuals getting out is whether they have a home plan or not. So by providing that assistance, we're also reducing our population and saving money. So the cost-benefit analysis works, and it also, housing permanence is one of those barriers to people being successful.
Let's take a phone call from Nicole in Lancaster. Nicole, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I would like to know what things can be done on a county level. We have Lancaster County Prison here, where I realize nobody spends longer than a year there, but there are still people there that would benefit from some of the programs that you're speaking of, as well as who is funding and working these programs. Because we do have some in place, like the diversion program, but it's not funded, and it's not working. People are trying to get through these programs, and they're being set up for failure instead of for success.
Thank you very much for your call. What about that?
Okay, let me differentiate county jails from state prisons. County jails are funded by county property tax dollars. It's generally probably the biggest expenditure in the county. Average length of stay in counties across Pennsylvania are about 60 days. So from a programmatic standpoint, it's a much more challenging environment because people turn over so quickly. Mm-hmm. From a resource standpoint, certainly counties do not have the resources that the state does. But on the positive end, I think most counties do a great job with things like work release and having relationships with local employers that get people employed coming out. Also, most counties, including Lancaster County, as I'm aware of, have a huge volunteer base that often delivers programming. But the county jails are the most challenging thing in the criminal justice system, as far as I'm concerned. You talk about someone coming off the street, so you're going to be dealing with detox issues. You're going to be dealing with oftentimes really acute mental illness. And on top of that, it's not like people come in with papers that say, I'm detoxing or I'm suffering from mental illness. So counties have to triage. And it really is like an emergency room. And then once they identify that, then they have to find a way to get the resources to identify those needs in a really short period of time. So it's a super challenging environment. I think we have some counties who do a really good job here in Pennsylvania. I think some of the diversion programs in a lot of our counties, some of the specialty courts, we've seen veterans courts, drug courts, DUI courts, do a really good job with that. I mean, our premise has always been that the rubber really meets the road at the counties. And if there's ways, and part of the philosophy behind justice reinvestment is taking some of the savings from the reduction in population, investing it at the county level, especially in county probation and parole.
Any kind of assistance to counties from the state level?
Just a meager amount of investment in county probation and parole. And some funding through the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency for intermediate punishment or diversion into drug treatment. And that in particular has the best outcomes in the system. So the Justice Reinvestment 2, which we tried to get passed in the last term and kind of hit a wall, we're going to be reintroducing it and putting a big push on this. That really specifically seeks to put some significant investments in county intermediate punishment in diversion programs. And again, to get ready to deal with this opioid epidemic, it really makes sense to do that.
You know, and I hope you don't mind me jumping around on you with some of these things, but, you know, when you, even though today's prison is a lot different from what it was years ago, from even what you're describing, that it sounds like there truly is some attempts at rehabilitation and that successful in quite a few cases. But when I hear about an inmate saying, or someone who has offended, that they'd much rather be in a county jail than a state prison, I mean, these are tough places. So when someone says that, I mean, from what you're describing, it sounds as if there's, I don't want to say opportunities, but more potential to turn your life around in a state prison than even in a county prison.
Yes and no. I mean, I think that's it's a somewhat difficult question in that. So you look at a county prison, less resources, generally less programs, but also lower level people in there, right?
As far as crime goes.
So lower risk level, smaller. Housing units are smaller. Generally, the officer to inmate ratio is smaller. Generally, you'll have an officer on a housing unit with maybe 40, 50, 60 inmates. We certainly don't have those staffing levels. Connection to family. So when you're in a county jail, generally you're in a county jail in your county. So more opportunity for visits. And folks don't want to be incarcerated, so you better get out. Now, state prison, certainly more resources, more programs. If you're going to serve a long time, you want to serve it in a state prison. But by the same token, if choosing, I think you probably would want to stay closer to home.
I don't know about that wording you just used. If you're going to serve a long time, you want to serve it in a state prison. It just saying, but
yeah, it's a different world I live in, man.
All right, let's take a call from Dennis in Lancaster. Dennis, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to say hi to Secretary Wetzel. I've done work with Justice and Mercy here in Lancaster, and I worked for 1 year at Camp Hill, 1976. I was saving up money for graduate school, and I worked a lot of time, basically lived in there. And I don't know if you guys planned this, but it was 100 years ago today that prohibition went into effect, and it was the first wave of mass incarceration that took place in this country. And of course, when you read the history of it, a lot of it was driven by racial the underclass or whatever. And of course, back at that point in time, they made alcohol illegal, but marijuana was still legal. And and I called in the other week when district attorney was on there and commenting. I still read the paper every day in Lancaster, and I see about half of the police log for people getting arrested for marijuana. And then when they started the war on drugs, it really boosted up the mass incarceration. These were for political reasons as well, if you look at what happened now with Nixon and everything. So I just wanted to comment on that. It's very, I don't know if you guys planned this, but
no, we didn't plan.
This was the start of this whole thing with mass incarceration that took place, and it was a good idea, to, like they call it the grand experiment, the noble experiment, but it was a total failure to try to police the populace and stop them from, ingesting whatever they wanted to ingest, nonviolent crime. So I'll hang up and listen.
Hey, Dennis, thank you very much for your call. No, it wasn't planned, but I was aware. I saw that this morning, one of those this day in history things. It was 100 years ago today that prohibition went into effect. But to his point, and along with the research comes history as mm-hmm. well. There are certain points in our history over the last 50 years where crime has been up. politicians have said, okay, we have to respond. The public has demanded action. I think back to what, you know, he referred to as President Nixon's war on drugs. That is one of the reasons that many, many more people were incarcerated. When Governor Ridge became governor here in Pennsylvania, there was a special session on crime. That's where a lot of the mandatory sentences came from. Now we're in a situation where crime has decreased for the last 20 years. You're talking about decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana for recreational purposes. So all these things seem to be cyclical, but when you're looking at this research, is history part of it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that what we've done poorly historically as a criminal justice system is learn from history. I think the premise, and I think if you focus around the crack era, right, we had both sides of the aisle screaming to lock people up for a longer period of time, right? But we didn't put any measurements in place. We didn't set a goal. So I think that what we're doing now, when you talk about research, you absolutely look at history and look what we did before, and things that work, we should continue to do it. I think the marijuana question is really interesting. When you look at the racial disparity, right, which one of the interesting things about our population reduction is 100%, slightly over 100% of our population reduction is in our non-white population. So it's factual that we've got less disparate as a result of the reforms we've made to the system, okay?
Okay, well, I don't want to look at the math there. 100%, so you're saying almost there was
over 100%, slightly over 100%.
Give me some numbers if you can. We had 1,068 fewer inmates in 2018 than at the end of 2017. So non-white, of that 1,068, the smaller prison population, what percentage of that is non-white?
Yeah, well, let's go over the 4,300 that were 4,300 less that we have since we passed Justice Reinvestment. Over 4,300 are non-white. So we have, at the last time we looked, we had of the 4,000 reduction, that was 100% represented by non-white population. Same thing happened in Connecticut. So there's several states that when they pushed the reform, it disproportionately had a positive impact on the group that was disproportionately negatively impacted before. Now, I think there's a couple other things that play into some of the racial disparity. One, Pennsylvania is the only state in the country that doesn't provide any state funding for indigent defense or public defenders. I think that disproportionately hits the non-white population. I think the other thing is bail reform, both of which are obviously on the governor's agenda, right? I think when you look at the numbers around bail, we use money as a proxy for risk. So people who don't have money are more likely to be incarcerated pretrial, which means you're more likely to serve more time pretrial, more likely to get sent to state prison. So I think those are two of the feeders. But drug use, if you look at research around drug use, you see whites and blacks use it at approximately the same percentage, but blacks are more likely to be arrested for it. So some of the talk around marijuana decriminalization could have a positive impact on racial disparity. Legalization, whole nother ballgame. And I know the governor mentioned at the very least we should
look at it, yeah.
Look at it. And frankly, you could make an argument that if New Jersey and New York, who are both talking about it, go legal, in essence, it's going to be legalized, right? Because it'll be coming across the borders. It's not like we have a border wall, right, in Jersey or New York.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel. We're talking about a number of topics, including the Clean Slate Law, the prison population down here in Pennsylvania. We're going to be talking about some other things as well. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, if you have a question or comment, is 1-800-729-7532. We have an email from Kyle, who ask, how has the introduction of drugs into the prison system been changed or lessened by the measures taken by the state prison system in September last year? Are drugs still getting in, even though mail is being processed through a secure location in another state? And this is one of the issues I did want to bring up, but Kyle does bring it up. And just for background purposes and context, this was something that last September, we talked to you during that time, that there was a decision made that mail would be processed differently. The original letters wouldn't get through. There would be scans of photographs because staff was getting sick, not knowing what kind of materials were on those fentanyl or whatever on the letters, the documents coming in. It's been very controversial. We'll talk about it. Let me just ask this question right now. What is the process? What is the policy right now? And then I'll get to Kyle's question.
Okay, for mail
yes.
in particular.
Yes.
So for mail, mail's sent to an address in Florida. It's scanned in. Email sent to the facility. The facility prints it out. What drove that is specifically K2 or Spice, odorless liquid that was being put on either on the paper or literally in some cases we've intercepted some intel where people were taking this, injecting it into the ink in the printer, so the letters on the paper were actually dry, and then they were smoking it. So both we had both staff exposed over a 2 month period. I think we sent about 60 staff, maybe more, out. We also sent 45 inmates out over that same 2 month period that predated the lockdown for drug overdoses. If you've ever seen, just Google or go into YouTube and Google what it looks like with someone who's on K2. They get very violent, often take their clothes off. I mean, it's an ugly, ugly buzz. So we did the scanning of the mail. We put a new process in place where people couldn't order books. We had to change the way people ordered books because they were getting books sent in from manufacturers that had, like, page 62 was in fact soaked in K2 or something like that. We created a new security processing center at SCI Rockview for donated books that all books come to. Think of it like U.S. Customs. So we create our own kind of little customs. Legal mail, we're scanning the legal mail, and that's probably been the most controversial. We're currently being sued by the ACLU over the legal mail. Previously, staff would open the legal mail in front of the inmate and search it. We modified the process where they open it in front of the inmate, copy it, give the inmate a copy, seal the original. We think it's constitutional. The ACLU does not. So we're in court over that. And then we modified how we did visits. We stopped vending in visits until we got these body scanners, similar to what you go through in the airport, that because people were bringing drugs in. Inmates were swallowing it. We had no way to detect it. Now we do. So as we, as the body scanners are being installed, and the body scanners we have to get DEP certification because they use some radiation. So about half our prisons now have them installed. Now we reintroduce vending. So yeah, probably the couple things still out there. We don't have a good photo solution. The scanning of photos is terrible.
I've seen some of the pictures.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah.
I'm optimistic that in the next 30 days we'll announce a solution that works. The quality of photos is important, and we're close to a solution on that.
Well, let me just backtrack for a moment, and then I will ask get back to Kyle's question about how it's worked. But you know, all the things you had talked about, you are trying to make sure that these offenders don't come back to prison. I know that one of the key parts of that is, you know, being close to family, that family members can visit often. But there have been complaints about this. Number one, privacy. You mentioned the ACLU, whether it's constitutional or not, privacy. Families have complained that they'll send a letter and there'll be pages missing. The photographs, that the scans are just not that good. So, you know, what you're trying to do to keep those people from coming back, I mean, I'm not trying to say you have to make them happy, but at the same time, you know that all those things are important to them. Obviously, you have to weigh one against the other.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I think For me, it starts with creating an environment inside prisons that people can get well and can get rehabilitated. Prisons inundated with drugs are violent prisons. When there's a lot of drugs, there's more drug trade, there's violence around that. So that's a foundational issue for me. I mean, if you look at, but so is family connections. I mean, we've done more than probably any department in the country when you talk about the First Chance Act, creating a funding mechanism to fund programs, not criminal justice programs, programs for children who are impacted by crime in high crime areas. You know, we've changed the environment, created child areas in every visit room and those kinds of things. So certainly we recognize and we value that family connection. And the photos, 100%, we have to have a better solution. There's no excuse for some of the horrible photos that come through. But the scanning of mail, I mean, that's, to me, that's not going to change.
And getting back to Kyle's question, has there been any measurable decrease in drugs getting into the prison?
Yes, there has. And you can go to our website, and we actually have a dashboard that shows, goes back to 2017 and shows by month things like, so I think the best measure from my standpoint is random drug tests. We do hundreds of random drug tests on inmates every month. We've done that forever. Our baseline historically has been about 0.3% positive, right? That's a great number. The month before the lockdown, August, that jumped to 1%. So a tripling of the amount of positive drugs. You got a drug problem, and people say it's only 1%. It's a prison, okay? 1% is unacceptably high. That dropped the month after we made the changes, that dropped back down to, I think, 0.4%. So that's been a good indicator, although last month it popped back up to 0.7%, which we're not happy about. But we have all kinds of indicators, how many people get sent out to the hospital by month. And again, when we put these things in place, we immediately create a dashboard to say, look, these are the indicators. I mean, we're not cooking the books on this. These are the actual numbers. When you look, you see a gradual increase in bad indicators on drugs. We made the changes. Now you're seeing a decrease. So yeah, they did, but we have to strike a balance. I mean, I won't disagree that we have to strike a balance to make sure we're maintaining those family connections and those kinds of things. For me, scanning of regular mail, whether you get a copy of a regular mail or actual regular mail, I don't think that does anything to not have, I mean, we always had the ability to search regular mail anyhow. We had the ability to read regular mail. So that's not a privacy issue.
What about an attorney sending mail to someone who's incarcerated?
So that's where we open it in front of the inmate, scan it, and we do that on camera. I would argue that the new search procedures are actually less invasive than the previous ones, and the fact is we have it on camera, so there's no question. But again, I think that's one that the federal courts will decide.
Thomas asks, how much has the private prison industry pushed back against drug reform?
I'm sure some. I don't really know that for a fact. Pennsylvania's not a state that's embraced private prisons. As a matter of fact, there's one private county jail. That's Delaware County. We have zero private state prisons, and as long as I'm here, we will always maintain zero. I'm not a fan of the private prison industry necessarily, but they're booming now under the Trump era, especially with their immigration beds.
Another listener asks, is clean slate the same as having your record expunged? How does a job applicant address his or her criminal record?
So there's actually a website. The administration and Governor Wolf did a press conference a couple weeks ago, partnering with the Bar Association, where folks can go to, I think it's Clean Slate. If you just Google Pennsylvania Clean Slate, it'll
get
you to the
By the way, we're going to have Representative DeLosier and a couple other people on next Tuesday, I believe it is,
okay,
talking more about Clean Slate, so we can get some of the nuts and bolts of it.
But the key is it's not the same as an expungement. Clean Slate seals the record so it can be used for criminal justice purposes, can't be used for employment purposes.
Let's take a call from Curtis in McConnellsburg. Curtis, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've been out for 15 years after serving a 22-year sentence, and I'm wondering, back when I was on parole, my parole officer would have me go along and discuss things about how I changed and what, you know, direction I was going to go in after I got out and how I did it. I think a lot of it's just self-determination, and you just get the craps of it, and you just say, that's it, I'm done.
So you're basically you're saying that it's on the individual to change his or her life.
Yeah, I mean, after serving that much time, you get to a point, and the secretary is right, that if you're going to do something, you want to do it in state prison, and you want to learn, and you want to learn, and you got to say, okay, you know what? When am I going to grow up? When am I going to accept responsibility for my actions?
Thank you very much for your call, and it sounds like he's on the right path.
So I would love to hear success stories. One of the challenges about this this field is you rarely see your successes. You see your failures because they come back a lot. But I think I agree that at some point an individual has to make the choice to try to get on the right path. And I think the system's role is to identify what the root causes of the crime were and then provide programming to address. I mean, if you didn't graduate, if you're black in Pennsylvania and didn't graduate and drop out of school, you have a 70% lifetime likelihood of being incarcerated. If we don't address that lack of education, it's one of the reasons why I love Governor Wolf's and Secretary Rivera's push on education, especially early childhood education and pre-K, because that's ground-level crime prevention.
Heath is in New Cumberland. Heath, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I'd like to just say that we're pretty much inundated by prisons in the central Pennsylvania area here, and I was wondering if we could get back to more of a skilled labor type atmosphere from our people that are left go in, back out into the communities, and perhaps make some of these large warehouses and so forth that are empty that you see for lease, you know, systems of hydroponics and systems of skilled labor. And maybe I'm just trying to dream of some angelic situation. But
I know what you're saying. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your call. You kind of talked about this earlier when you were talking about some of the skills. But just to reiterate, we are in a job market right now where there are a lot of job openings, but we are lacking especially skilled workers. I mean, I hate to say it, but is that a good avenue for, number one, the former offenders, the ex-offenders, to get some type of skill and then match it up with these employers who are having trouble finding employees?
Yes. So a couple programs that I think are higher end that you wouldn't think of being offered in prisons that we offer. One is for optical technicians. It's probably the best program we have in our system. It's at SCI Cambridge Springs, so female inmates up by Erie, and they learn how to make glasses. It's a huge need in the market, and if you're in that program and you get certified in that program, you will get an interview before you even leave by phone and have a job when you hit the ground. Second one is fiber optics. We started that program, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, and since we're a wireless world, there's actually wire that creates wireless, right? And providing that skill. So one of the things that was anticipated by this Department of Ed grant is that we'd really look at what those offerings are and then modify our programs inside. I also want to mention the Pell experiment. So we currently are offering higher ed funded by federal Pell grants that was allowed by the Obama administration. We're partnering with Bloomsburg, IUP, Villanova, Lehigh Carbon Community College, providing higher ed inside prisons. Mm.
Secretary Wetzel, always interesting talking to you. There's so many things going on in Pennsylvania. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you for being with us today. So clean slate is one. The federal government, President Trump actually signed legislation for the federal level earlier. So what are we looking at in the future here? And with the bottom line of the public being safe.
Yeah, I mean, the governor contextualized it. The first conversation he had in public on criminal justice, he said two things: less crime, less victims. We can do that with less people incarcerated and being less punitive, too. And that makes us more fair. And I think that's really, you're going to see a big push. I think the governor 3 or 4 times yesterday during his inauguration speech mentioned criminal justice reform. So stay tuned. We're going to be doing big things to make the community more safe and the system more fair.
You were at the inauguration yesterday?
I was.
Okay, and you were at the Eagles Saints game on Sunday?
I was.
Which one was more fun? I'm not going to put you on the spot with that one. Secretary
Wolfpack,
John Wetzel.
Team Wolf.
Secretary John Wetzel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Chesapeake Bay Foundation has its report card out on the bay. Unfortunately, with all the rain that we've gotten in 2018, the grade has gone down. We'll be talking about the state of the bay, the health of the bay, coming up on tomorrow's program.